Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. The track record for candidates who have launched primary challenges against a sitting president isn't good. It's been more than a generation since it happened. When conservative commentator Pat Buchanan challenged President George H.W. Bush for renomination in 1982, Buchanan failed, as did Ted Kennedy when he went up against President Jimmy Carter in 1980 and Ronald Reagan's challenge to Gerald Ford 4 years earlier. Despite surviving those intra-party challenges, each president went on to ultimately lose their re-election bids. Perhaps that's why figures in the so-called Never Trump wing of the Republican Party have been looking for a primary challenger to Donald Trump since pretty much Inauguration Day. But no one stepped up until former Massachusetts Governor William Weld entered the fray earlier this year, followed in late August by former Illinois Congressman and conservative talk show host Joe Walsh. Now, former South Carolina Governor and Congressman Mark Sanford's hat is in the ring. He announced his candidacy on Sunday with a platform of fiscal conservatism, and he wants the party to have a conversation about what it means to be a Republican in the Trump era. He is here to talk about his candidacy. Governor Mark Sanford, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Why do you want to be president?
Because I think we're headed down the wrong road, and I think that we need to change course. I think we're walking our way toward the most predictable financial crisis in the history of man. And what's interesting about that is those are not my words, but those are the words of another North Carolinian, Erskine Bowles, as he wrapped up the Bowles-Simpson Commission. And if you look at the numbers under this administration, the numbers have gone far worse, though this president said when he was running, if you elect me, I'll eliminate the debt over the 8 years that I might be in office.
What's driving the debt in your mind?
What drives the debt in every case, which is too much spending.
But on what?
On a whole host of things. I mean, in other words, there's not one category of expenditure. I mean, there are a whole host of things across the board that are a problem. And so I think that we've been lulled into sleep by the way that political forces and politicians have sort of become the equivalents of pastry chefs. If you don't like this dessert, how about this one? If you don't like this one, how about this one? And that's a long way from sort of the country doctor approach of this medicine isn't going to taste particularly good, but boy, if we, you know, it will heal you, and if we don't take it, you're going to be a whole lot worse. We have a profound deficit problem. We're running more than $1 trillion deficits now, which we've never done before in peacetime. As you look out over the next 10 years, we have the highest debt we've ever had, and we have obviously spending the dry bones.
So where would you start cutting? Because people, it's one thing, spending sneaks up on you. Everybody knows that, who has a family budget.
Family checkbook. It's like, oh my goodness, how did all this stuff add up like it did?
Exactly right. Yeah. Cutting is painful. So where would you cut? If you had the White House right now and you had the pen, what would you slash?
Well, first of all, you'd have to make the case for why you need to cut. And that case has not been made. And I go back to the pastry chef example. And so, you know, there's on the Democratic side right now, there's a debate of more versus more. I've watched several debates now, and there's not been any conversation on debt or deficit or government spending. And then on the Republican side, the president's labeled himself indeed the king of debt and doesn't challenge people on this front. I think we first need to have a conversation around the kitchen counter as Americans. In where do we want to go and what do we perceive to be sustainable? Our numbers by any economic reckoning, from the right or from the left, are not sustainable. And so if you're from the left, you'd say, whatever it is that I want out of government, I want it to be there over the long run. And if you're from the right, you'd say, whatever it is that I want it there for the long run. Our numbers are not sustainable. So I believe that if you first had that conversation and there was real leadership, and leadership is not a tweet on this subject. I mean, it's actually going around the country and saying, let's walk through our numbers. Here's the problem. Here's why. I mean, most people don't know that we will spend next year more on interest than we do on all programs on behalf of children at the federal level. Most people don't know that within 36 months, we will spend more on interest than we do on national defense. Most people don't know that it now takes every tax return west of Texas, save California, just to pay the interest in the national debt, and that the interest is the fastest growing expenditure within the federal government. As to where I would cut, I believe across the board. I mean, I think that if you made the case in the ways in which Admiral Mike Mullen, who was the former chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, was right, and it was his reckoning as a military man when asked, what's the biggest threat to the American civilization? He answered, not the Taliban, not the Chinese, not the Russians, but the American debt. If you made that case, people would get in the boat together based on what the founding fathers inscribed on the back of a penny, which says "De pluribus unum," from the many one, and say, okay, if you'll take a little pain, I'll take a little bit of pain. We'll all get in the boat together if we see it as a threat. Americans have an amazing way of rallying to solve problems when they recognize it's a problem. And this hadn't been recognized as a problem. So I was the author of a program called the Penny Plan when I was in Congress, and it would take a penny a year out of every dollar benefit of every federal program out there in the event that Congress didn't come up with targeted cuts. It's a way of forcing targeted cuts, and I think it would be an appropriate starting point.
Would you raise taxes?
No, I think that...
Why not? Isn't that part of the problem? We still eat like we're starving to death and spending money on the food we buy, metaphorically
right.
speaking. But what about making more money?
Well, I think you could certainly look at redistribution of the money that comes in. But if you look over the last 70 years, it's been very consistent. In a high rate environment, a low rate environment, the take to government, so to speak, has been about 18% of GDP. What that means in English is about 18% of all that we as Americans make and earn and produce goes to the federal government. That number has been remarkably consistent. Again, regardless of whether we had high rates in some cases, low rates in others. In other words, in put in common sense terms, you can only squeeze but so much blood from a turnip. I don't think you can deviate far from that 18% number, given the way in which it's been inelastic for about 70 years.
One of the things you said about your campaign is that you want to spark a needed conversation with the country about Republicans and what it means to be a Republican. Republicans were always the fiscal conservatives. They were always the grown-ups in the room. What happened?
No more.
What happened?
I don't know.
What happened?
I mean, that's the $94 question, and that's really the premise of the campaign. The campaign will have legs if all of those thousands of conversations that I had with people over my time in office, I mean, as governor, I can't tell you the number of small businesses that I visited with, and people would talk about how they're struggling to make their numbers work, and they had this issue or that issue, or the families that I talked to that were talking about the numbers that mattered to them. And what people are saying now is that no, debt and deficits don't matter. It's no longer an issue. Now, if that's true, my campaign will be short-lived. If it's not true, those conversations that I had over all those years of politics were real, and those people are there, though they've not been spoken to lately, it'll have some degree of duration.
But as you know, it's very difficult to run against an incumbent president, particularly if you're in that president's party. It's very difficult. And as you're witnessing, even in South Carolina, the cancellation of the primary there, which we can talk about in a second. But if you're coming to the table with a kind of a lecture to the people that suddenly we've been fat, dumb, and happy, and the bill is now due, and we've got to suffer because the bill is due, that's not a message people want to hear. So can you...
It's the truth. And whether or not we want to hear it doesn't alleviate the fact that it's true.
But that doesn't help your campaign.
Well, I don't know. Because that's the bigger conversation that needs to take place. I think Democrats have pandered. I think Republicans have pandered to different audiences, but pandered in both cases. And what I think is interesting is if you have insomnia, I got just the book for you. It's entitled "This Time It's Different," written by a professor from Harvard, a professor from the University of Maryland, and they chronicle the last 800 years of financial history as it relates to governments. And what they found is that in every instance or near every instance, basically policymakers got to a decision point where they had to decide, do we go back to what made us competitive and perhaps a world power in the first place, or do we stay in this happy, comfortable, but ultimately unsustainable cycle that we're on with regard to spending and debt? Mm-hmm. And 9 times out of 10, the civilizations chose the comfy route, and that was the seeds of that civilization's undoing. And so I think that if you had an earnest conversation with people and you said, look, these are the numbers. I mean, I didn't create them. I didn't make them. I've fought, in fact, on the other side of the equation in terms of trying to limit some of them. We got to have a conversation, because the history of these things is, if we don't do it proactively, then the financial markets do it for us. And that process is wrenching for people's savings, their retirement accounts, their prospects for a job, and frankly, the opportunities for the kids and grandkids.
We have an email from one of our listeners as we've been talking. Bruce emails, what would the debt look like had we not given $1 trillion to the top 10% of the population, or 1% of the population, with the Trump tax cuts?
You know, it'd look a little bit different, but not that much. I mean, I made national news at the time when I said, this fundamentally is not a middle-class tax cut. It's not going to help individuals. Fundamentally, it's a corporate tax reduction and restructuring bill that's aimed at some level of making us more competitive. If you look at our corporate tax rate versus other industrialized countries at that time, we were well out of step. And so we had corporate inversions, we had relocations, and the idea is, could we become more competitive than that?
Yeah.
You could argue for or against the merits of doing that, but that's what it was aimed at, though it was advertised a bit differently.
You voted for it.
Totally.
Why?
Because, again, it was an educated bet on making our country more competitive versus other industrialized countries around the globe. And if you look at the overall revenue stream, federal government, based on the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office number of projections, our federal government will take in $43 trillion over the next 10 years without the tax cut. With the tax cut, it'll take in $41.5 trillion. That's, again, the $1.5 trillion difference. That's a 2.5% difference over the 10 years. Mm-hmm. So what I think is at times disingenuous is that people say, I can't believe we passed this tax cut, you know, and my point is, wait a minute, it's a 2.5% difference. You could argue for or against it based on one's political ideology, or based on their thinking of whether or not it's a good idea, but what you can do is say, that's a huge problem, but we're not going to have any conversation on the more than $1 trillion deficits. We're not running over 10 years, but over just 1 year. As you may have seen it just yesterday, it was announced that we've already passed the $1 trillion mark in this fiscal year, and it's going to get worse.
So, Governor, we have less than a minute left, and Democrats in the House Judiciary Committee are set to take the biggest step toward impeachment proceedings against the president in the coming weeks. They plan to vote tomorrow to turn the committee's investigations into an impeachment inquiry. As somebody challenging the president, are you in favor of impeachment?
I think not. I mean, I think that it'd probably be a mistake politically. We saw that in the Clinton years. That's what an election's for. If people don't like them, they should throw them out. I think it's just much more direct, and it doesn't involve the sort of political intrigue of this camp versus that camp. No, make the case in the public forum. That's why South Carolina's making a huge mistake by not holding a primary. People would like to learn more where I'm coming from, and ask, they look me up at MarkSanford.com.
Okay, and I know that you're a candidate, along with Bill Weld and Joe Walsh and the president himself. If the president leaves the convention in next summer here in Charlotte as the nominee, will you vote for him?
I'm an issue guy. I mean, I think there's a probability that I would be there versus other places, simply because I believe in the debt deficit issue as being a critical linchpin to what comes next in the American way. And, you know, with all due respect to Bernie Sanders, his numbers are even worse than what the president's proposed. So I'll look at it at that time, but I'd probably be predisposed to do that.
Governor Mark Sanford, formerly governor of South Carolina, running for president against Donald Trump in the Republican primaries, if there are any. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Take care.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.